from GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. There are at least 174 Confederate memorials in Georgia, all displayed on public land. What are all these statues trying to tell us?
Give the monument context, and Augustans of every race can embrace it. Take the monument away, and brief satisfaction will be followed by silence.
That's the opinion of author Steve Oney. He's talking about the 76-foot marble column in Augusta. All this hour, we'll hear from people across Georgia about what Confederate markers mean to them. We'll also hear how Decatur plans to remove a central landmark. And in North Georgia, Rome wants to repair a recently defaced statue of Johnny Reb. We'll also look at these symbols through the lens of African-American history. Georgia state law from the early 1900s says no publicly owned military monument can be removed or changed unless it's, quote, to preserve, protect, or help interpretation, end quote. That is not the case across the entire South. Just last year, New Orleans removed 4 Confederate monuments.
These statues are not just stone and metal. They're not just innocent remembrances of a benign history. These monuments celebrate a fictional sanitized Confederacy, ignoring the death, ignoring the enslavement, ignoring the terror that it actually stood for.
That's New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu. Here are your first thoughts.
For me, they don't represent much of anything. They're just statues from the past.
It reminds me that lynching is still in living memory.
No one wants to be reminded of all the times where people felt like you as a person.
I'm old enough to know what went on, but I think they need to stay. It's a sign of freedom.
We should have a vote on it.
You just heard Suliatio from Broxton, Mary Lee Lucas in Decatur, Doris Wilson in Fayetteville, Mike in Tucker, Regina McDuffie from Lizella. W.S. Lizon emails, the monuments are not about owning slaves. These are, quote, monuments to enemy combatants, end quote. As always, as we enter this special hour of coverage on Confederate monuments, I want to be clear about my perspective on the issue. I'm a mixed-race woman. My ancestors were slaves on a plantation near Milledgeville. I cannot pretend that I'm unbiased on the issue of Confederate monuments. But I'm a professional-trained journalist, and I welcome an open, honest conversation from all sides on the issue. I do not make public policy. My job is only to give you the information and let you decide as objectively as possible. As always, we don't just welcome your comments. We want you to enter the conversation with us. So call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter at OST Talk, post to Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Last month, the DeKalb County Commission voted to relocate the monument that's currently in Decatur Square. But that process to take down the monument may be harder in Georgia than it is in pretty much any other state. With me now is the state senator for Decatur, Elena Parent. Hello there.
Hi.
And also with us for this entire hour is Andra Gillespie. She's a professor of political science at Emory University. Welcome back, Andra.
Thank you.
Elena, I mentioned a moment ago this Georgia state law that's more than 100 years old saying that you can't move any marker to a war except under certain circumstances. What are the circumstances under which you can remove a monument like this?
Well, the state law is a little confusing, Celeste, because it's got several subparagraphs, and different parts of the statute apply to different entities. So one of the things that I've been trying to tease out, and the DeKalb County attorney and many others have been thinking about over this time, is what part actually applies to actions taken by local governments. Here we have a 30-foot obelisk that's under discussion in DeKalb County. It is, again, it had to be researched, but it is owned by DeKalb County, and DeKalb County is a local government. That means DeKalb County's options are different than if the monument was owned by the state, for example.
I see. But at this point, we don't actually have the answer to how you go about either moving it or removing it, right?
Well, the DeKalb County attorney, O.V. Brantley, did issue a legal memorandum saying that in her analysis that I have gotten a semi-agreement out of our legislative council at the General Assembly on, that DeKalb County could relocate the monument or contextualize it. However, it cannot be removed. So if it were relocated, it
removed would, and just disappeared.
Correct. It cannot disappear. It cannot be covered. If it is relocated, it would have to go somewhere that where the public could go see it.
Andra, take us back in time to when this law was passed. Again, we're talking quite some, over 100 years ago. Why did they need a law protecting these? I mean, the law protects any marker, but really we're talking about Confederate memorials. Why did we need it?
Well, I mean, it's in part, historians talk about this and are probably in a better position to be able to answer the question. But when they put these monuments up, they went up with great fanfare. And they were expected to be preserved to try to reinforce the nostalgia of the lost cause. And so this is a nice way to say that even if this falls out of favor in future generations, that this is, you know, you can put these laws in and then you have to deal with them forever so that, you know, their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren have fewer options about how to deal with them. I mean, you know, and one of the things that's actually really interesting about this time period, not just with respect to Confederate monuments, but with respect to voting rights and other things, because so this is what historians call the nadir of African-American history, was that a lot of the laws that were made were facially neutral. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were real things. They knew that they, on their face, had to provide equal protection to African Americans. But yet they came up with all of these really interesting laws that were then supported by the Supreme Court that on their surface weren't necessarily explicitly racist in their nature, but had the effect of having the exact same impact.
I want to actually play a little bit of tape for you. Now, this is not the markings from the Decatur Monument. This is actually what is engraved on the Augusta Confederate Monument, which is 76 feet tall, commissioned by the Ladies Memorial Association. Here is a portion of the inscription on that monument.
Worthy the fadless fame which Confederate soldiers lost, who gave themselves in life and death for us, for the honor of Georgia, for the rights of the states, for the liberties of the South, for the principles of the Union, as these were handed down to them. By the fathers of our common country, no nation rose so white and fair, none fell so pure of crime.
Our Confederate dead. Now, I don't remember exactly what the one in Decatur says, but it's really similar.
It is. It is.
Very similar. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I emphasize the part where it says, no nation rose so white and fair, none fell so pure of crime. What kind of complaints have you gotten, Elena?
Right. The Decatur one does say something similar. After 42 years, another generation bears witness to the future that these men were of a covenant keeping race who held fast to the faith, on and on. So right. Again, mentioned sort of a similar thing. And this one was erected in 1908. And this was right around the time of the Atlanta race riots. So this one appears to have been erected. And, you know, a lot of these are right by courthouses. Mm-hmm. So that gives the significance is it's a message. The law applies differently to you. We celebrate this sort of superiority of the white race. And you can see that in both of those inscriptions.
Now, Andre, you specialize in political science. And here we have a bit of a tension between local control, which is very often a conservative catchphrase, and the protection of monuments. How did in many cases, the same political side that believes in states' rights, right, mm-hmm. and local control of government also be preventing municipalities from changing something in their own community?
Well, the tension between state government and national government is one thing, and so that's what we, you know, consider and argue about a lot in federalism. But local government exists at the pleasure of state government. And so that relationship is a little bit different. And so local government is dependent on state government. And I think it's also important to kind of keep in mind here is that by having state laws, it actually does provide local communities cover when they want to do certain things. So for instance, if you have a group of people, a vocal minority, maybe even a majority of people who want to get rid of a monument, then the local government can throw up their hands and say, well, we're kind of tied and constrained by state government and state statute that's there. And so I think it's really important to keep in mind, you know, one of the reasons why historically African Americans have tended to pursue the federal government for redress, why African Americans in particular tend to feel more confident in federal government than in state and local government, was that state and local government worked hand in hand to perpetuate discrimination, to enact Jim Crow laws. And so it's not surprising that there would be this tension. The tension exists now because of different types of politics, and especially a city like Decatur, a blue city and a red state. But, you know, back in the day, state and local government worked hand in hand to perpetuate white supremacy.
Let me play you, Elena, a comment. This is from a retired Episcopal priest here in Georgia, Father Lewis Bowler, and he's talking about the monument. Actually, he's referring specifically to the one in Augusta, but it's an argument you've probably heard.
For me, it's okay to remain there. It reminds us of an era that once existed, and we can use it as a stepping stone to not let it happen again, and certainly not as a rallying point for persons who felt in favor of it years ago.
What do you make of this argument that by removing monuments like this, or moving them, we are erasing or sanitizing history?
Celeste, I absolutely have heard that viewpoint from both white and black Georgians, and certainly these monuments do have historical value. The problem arises in the sense that there are so many of them, and they are in very important and public places. And so you start to consider, well, do all these, you know, the Decatur Town Square, the center of the community, does that really have to be the location for a Confederate monument? Might the community want something else there? Do all of them need to stay? And I think that those are questions that are very important for communities to wrestle with.
So what would you like to do with it? What would you like to, where would you like to move the monument that's in Decatur Square?
You know, I have heard a variety of proposals. One is to move it to the cemetery that's very nearby. There are already the graves of Confederate war dead and soldiers there. But I don't think the city of Decatur necessarily wants it to come onto a Decatur cemetery. The county commission is actually accepting proposals now. And some of the groups that have been interested in seeing the monument be relocated elsewhere have been working with civic groups. The Hate Free Decatur and Beacon Hill NAACP have been sort of soliciting ideas as well, so that there may be a public and willing place that would be appropriate for this monument. I myself think it's something that the local citizens and local government need to work out. And I've remained a little bit more focused on my role in discussing what the state law does and does not allow, and whether we need to make some changes to that state law to allow local governments to actually take action, particularly if we think that some of these monuments don't need to be just relocated, but whether some of them could be removed and something else put up in their place.
In the minute that we have left right now, Andra, is this always a partisan issue? Are we supposed to assume that a Republican will support keeping the monuments up and the Democrat will support removing them?
Well, I mean, you know, the potential options are multimodal, so it's not just take them up or remove them.
Right.
There are these intermediate steps about, you know, whether we add additional plaques to them or other types of things. And so, therefore, the distinguishing sort of features kind of vary. So during the Atlanta mayoral election, which is not partisan, but certainly was full of racial polarization, I did surveys trying to figure out sort of who's going to support Keisha Lance Bottoms and who was going to support Mary Norwood. And the modal sort of preference was moving response. And that's true amongst black and white voters. It's true amongst, you know, more Norwood supporters wanted to, you know, do other things with it. But, you know, the modal response amongst both groups was move.
That is Emory political science professor Andra Gillespie. She's with us this whole hour. And Elena Parent is state senator for Decatur. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We continue this conversation, what to do with Confederate memorials. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. All this hour, we explore the history and debate that surrounds Confederate monuments. A marker in the historic Myrtle Hill Cemetery was vandalized toward the end of last year. The statue featured a Confederate soldier holding a rifle. Cemetery staff in Rome found the soldier's face smashed and its hands gone. Stan Rogers is the cemetery's director.
It took some planning and premeditation to destroy that statue like it was tore up. What could provoke you into doing something like that after it's standing there on top of that monument for 108 years? What kind of mixed up, sick mind would cause you to do that? And my message to them would be, they need to get Jesus Christ in their life.
That Confederate soldier stood atop a monument. Dedicated in 1887, the monument was initially topped by an urn. The soldier replaced that urn in 1909. 377 soldiers are buried in the cemetery's Confederate section and more in other areas. Stan Rogers says the monument was created to pay tribute to them, but says that sense of tribute has changed.
It overlooked the other soldiers buried in the cemetery. So this soldier symbolically memorialized all veterans, not just the Confederate, but he was a Confederate soldier because at that time that was, you know, what the women of the Confederacy had done after the war.
Now the soldier that once stood atop the monument waits to be repaired. Stan chokes up as he describes the statue's future. He calls it a work of art.
I mean, it was just devastating that beautiful, I mean, this is made out of granite, Georgia granite. It wasn't a marble statue. It was made out of granite. And it took something to bust it up like it was busted up. I'm working with two companies now for us to get it repaired and placed back in on top of the monument.
Stan wouldn't say how much repairs will cost. He's still accepting bids for the restoration. While that cost falls on the city of Rome, there are individual donations coming in. Meanwhile, no one has been charged with vandalizing the statue. Stan says he understands why Confederate monuments upset so many people, but
I believe that a lot of people have been misled about the history. I believe that some of the soldiers probably didn't believe in the reasons for the war, but they fought anyway. The Confederate soldiers, they were loyal to the southern states. The Union soldiers, they were loyal to the northern states. It's a sense of loyalty, I think, more than reason.
Stan Rogers says it could be a year before Myrtle Hill Cemetery's Confederate soldier takes its place once again atop the monument. The Confederate statue in Rome was added to the cemetery monument in 1909. The Southern Poverty Law Center says that was the first of two times when a large number of Confederate memorials and markers were dedicated. And my next guest says it is important to understand not just what these monuments stand for, but when they were created. Elizabeth Herrin-Triant teaches the history of the Jim Crow era at the University of Massachusetts. Lowell, good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
And still with us is Emory University political science professor Andra Gillespie. Been studying Confederate monuments. Good to have you back, Andra.
Thank you.
So, Elizabeth, the first Jim Crow law was passed in 1877, not very long after the Civil War ended. Why did statues begin to go up then and the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, so as you mentioned, there are these two spikes in Confederate monument building. So the first one is, you know, it's not coming right after the Civil War, right? It's not coming in 1865. It's coming later. So beginning around 1900 through World War One is that first big spike. So this is when Jim Crow is hardening in the southern states, when segregation is spreading from, you know, cemeteries are being segregated and institutions for the insane, et cetera, just spreading everywhere. Then the second big spike is during the Civil Rights Movement, so about 1955 to 1965.
So, Andra, take us back to the political moment that justified Jim Crow laws and why they ended up being so varied, similar in many southern states.
Well, I mean, what's starting to happen in the latter part of the 19th century is that with the end of Reconstruction, with the agreement for the federal government to stop overseeing the integration of blacks into southern societies, that gives southern states carte blanche to try to, you know, they can't go back to slavery, but they have to sort of figure out a way to corral black bodies. And so they start to do that with black codes and Jim Crow laws. And they start to do this by, you know, rewriting southern constitutions, state constitutions, to try to figure out ways to get around the 15th Amendment to disenfranchise people. And they do so effectively until the Voting Rights Act gets passed in 1965. And so this is just another sort of part of that we're going to demonstrate the power, and the federal government isn't going to do anything to protect blacks at this point because they chose not to.
Talk about the federal government. But again, I want to remind listeners that this conversation involves you and we welcome your views. Here's a comment from Mike in Tucker, Georgia. He left this message about the largest Confederate monument in the world, which is at Stone Mountain.
As a Cherokee, I'm very offended. I'm reminded of the Trail of Tears. I'm reminded that that is a Cherokee rock of love. I'm reminded of that swastika that was painted on my door when I was a little child in Doraville. It reminds me of all the nooses hanging from the poplar trees in the Old South. Yes, this is Mike in Tucker, and I've got my chisel, and I'm going to Stone Mountain right now.
So then we get this view from Helen Latson in Douglasville.
I think that no matter how many we take down, until we change our thoughts about the Civil War and racism, that it's all for naught.
So let me bring this back to you, Elizabeth, because Andra mentioned that the relationship with the federal government and that these Jim Crow laws, I guess, were made constitutional. Is that fair to say by Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896?
Yes, yes. So Plessy versus Ferguson said that the federal law will allow the separation of black and white people. So saying as long as the separate accommodations are equal, that they're legal.
So then how do we get from that, separate and equal, to these Confederate monuments? Why are they related?
Well, they're related because they're giving a signal, right? They're telling what we value. So we still have these federal amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. 15th Amendment was just mentioned, right? The one that says that black men can now vote. So we still have these laws on the books, but the monuments are signaling that in spite of these laws, black people can expect to be second-class citizens, right? So the monuments are saying we value these ideas that the Confederacy stood for, that blacks are not, worthy of being full citizens, that in fact they should be slaves. And so these statues, put that on the landscape.
Andre mentioned earlier that many of these memorials went up in front of courthouses or mm-hmm. near city and town governments. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, I mean, one, it's in part, it shows a public-private partnership. So oftentimes if you look at the statues, it'll note sort of who puts them up. And
I've looked at every single memorial in Georgia, and almost all of them were paid for by the United States.
Daughters of the Confederacy. Yeah. Right. And they're really interesting gender things about implicating women in this, because oftentimes the stereotypes about women being the voice of reason and all these kinds of things, and yet they are putting their lot in with the lost cause and sort of creating this kind of counter-narrative and this alternative history about things that happen. But these partnerships are created, oftentimes to great fanfare, to sort of, talk about the sort of the justness of the cause. So in some ways, it's actually very unrepentant. So, this was part of that integration process. It wasn't just about integrating slaves as full citizens into the United States right after the Civil War. There was also a conversation about, well, how do we integrate the South back into the Union? And so here, I would interpret this as Southern communities that were redefining the terms on which they were going to be American citizens again. And one of those terms is, we're not sorry for the Civil War. And we weren't wrong. I mean, because a lot of the language that you see on some of these inscriptions talks about the justness of the cause. So if I could read for a second, this is on the Jefferson Davis Monument in Richmond, Virginia. With constancy and courage unsurpassed, he sustained the heavy burden laid upon him by his people. When their cause was lost with dignity, he met defeat with fortitude. He endured imprisonment and suffering with entire devotion. He kept the faith. So, I mean, this is a guy who ran away, but, we won't get into that part, but...
That's an entirely different story. All right, let me play for you, Elizabeth. If you're just joining us, we're speaking about when the two periods of time when most of these Confederate memorials went up, and we're speaking with Andra Gillespie of Emory University and Elizabeth Herbin Triant of University of Massachusetts Lowell. So here is Serge Lecomte. He's in Smyrna, and he thinks there's a role for Confederate monuments.
There's definitely a value. It's sort of like with the situation, in Germany. You can't totally erase history, and people are already forgetting that the Holocaust existed. People believe that it didn't exist. So you need those statues and memorials around to, since it is a part of history, and prove and show to people that it actually did happen,
So Elizabeth, if there was these peaks, if we look at when most of these memorials were dedicated and put onto public land, he's talking about the historical value of that. Was there more of a historical remembrance value to them, or did they have a political bent?
They have a political bent, for sure. And I would want to respond to the historical argument by saying, let's put them in a museum, right? If they're a historical artifact, a museum is probably the best spot for them, right? We don't have other historical artifacts sort of in public squares in front of courthouses. I think, as I mentioned before, if the purpose of a monument is to show the public what we value, then, you know, this isn't the spot for something that's just about saying this happened in history, that happened in history.
So, Andre, when these two things went up, many people claim that the purpose of these monuments, the true purpose, was intimidation. Can we make a political argument for that?
Well, I mean, part of the research that I'm doing with my colleagues Michelle Gordon and Nikki Brown right now is to actually interrogate that by looking at the inscriptions. And one of the things, you know, Nikki points out, she's at the University of New Orleans, is that there was a monument in Louisiana, and the inscription is, "This is a monument to white supremacy," right? So, I mean, you can't get more blatant than that. And especially when people are sort of talking about the nobility of the cause a generation after it happened, I mean, that's still, you know, it there's a direct tie to that, to arguments today about how slavery really wasn't the cause of the Civil War, right? And so these things actually, you know, have implications for how we understand history, which then have policy implications in terms of what people's preferences are.
All right, that is political science professor Andre Gillespie of Emory University, and we heard from history professor Elizabeth Herbin-Triant of University of Massachusetts Lowell. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Andre is sticking around all this hour. We are talking about what to do with the dozens of Confederate monuments in Georgia. You know how to reach us, 404-500-9457, or find us on Twitter. Last summer, hundreds gathered in downtown Augusta to protest against a Confederate statue there. The NAACP also issued a statement that calls for its removal, but some say it should stay up. One of them is Steve Oney, author of the book And the Dead Shall Rise, The Murder of Mary Fagan and the Lynching of Leo Frank. Oney offers this commentary.
In the aftermath of Charlottesville, Confederate monuments became endangered species. Right-minded people agreed that if a statue of Robert E. Lee could bring horror to a Virginia college town, all of them must go. Now, 6 months later, it's time to think about what the region is losing in the rush to banish these icons. Might some deserve a reprieve? Consider, for instance, the one in Augusta. The 76-foot granite and marble monument that towers above Broad Street is more than just artistically impressive. Following the Civil War, the veteran who modeled for the statue atop it championed human rights. Indeed, he risked his life to defend Jewish factory boss Leo Frank, who was lynched in Marietta in 1915. The man on the monument, as old-time Augustans call him, was Sergeant Barry Benson. At 17, he joined the South Carolina Volunteers just across the Savannah River. He participated in the attack on Fort Sumter, and was at Appomattox in 1865 when Lee surrendered. The Augusta Chronicle called him the bravest of the brave Confederate soldiers. Yet Benson held no hatred for the North, and with the Union restored, he returned to Augusta. He established a successful accounting business and devoted his free time to assisting exploited textile workers and impoverished Black people. "I am ashamed of myself," he wrote, "when I fare better than they." While Benson was a proud Confederate veteran, he was also committed to a more fair-minded South. Charlottesville, however, changed everything. Benson's complexities, to the extent that anyone remembered, fell to the wayside. The Augusta branch of the NAACP demanded that the city take the monument down. Its fate remains uncertain. Ultimately, Augusta will decide whether Benson stays or goes. But here's an argument for keeping him. If presented to the public as an emblem of the Old South and as a beacon for the new, The monument can encourage what the region needs most, reflection and conversation. The only change required would be the installation of a carefully worded plaque explaining Benson's post-war activities. Give the monument context, and Augustans of every race can embrace it. Take the monument away, and brief satisfaction will be followed by silence.
That's Steve Oney, former Augustan and author of the book And the Dead Shall Rise, The Murder of Mary Fagan and the Lynching of Leo Frank. Just ahead, we continue this conversation of how you might contextualize many Confederate monuments. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we look at what's being done in Georgia to combat sexual harassment and assault within the state's booming film industry. We'll learn about an initiative to make the industry safer and hold perpetrators accountable, and we would love to hear from you. Have you ever experienced sexual misconduct at work? And then what was the outcome? Did you actually complain? Give us a call and leave a message. We're at 404-500-9457. And of course, be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. We've talked all this hour about Georgia's Confederate memorials. Now let's visit one. In Athens, you almost certainly run into the obelisk downtown that memorializes Confederate soldiers. It sits right on Broad Street, just feet away from UGA's famous arches. Producer Trevor Young went to Athens to ask locals how they feel about it, and he met a couple taking pictures right in front of the monument.
One for the money. One, two, three. Bingo. Beautiful. We're just two friends chilling today, and she had this film camera, and I was like, yo, let's take some pics. I think there's totally two sides to it. Like, it's an old piece of history, but at the same time, like, the Confederacy is slightly racist, so it's just like, do I delete a piece of history or acknowledge it, but like, is acknowledging it worshiping it? So it's just like, what do we do?
Oh, hey y'all, I'm Journey. My opinion on it, I mean, it's whatever. It just doesn't bother me. I'm not in that time era of like a lot of racism, like really being bold and out, so it really doesn't bother me because it's not like out there so much. Even though it's still out there, it's not out there, if that makes any sense, I guess.
My name is Keith Wilson from Florence, South Carolina. I have great reverence for it because you have to remember that Congress in the early 1900s said all Civil War and Confederate soldiers were then considered U.S. soldiers and were granted rights of veterans of America. So those monuments not only are honors to them, it's an honor to soldiers all over the world and all over America, both sides.
Have you ever read the Articles of Secession? And when you read that language, I'm not telling you it's good, bad, or indifferent, but read that language. Because when I read it, I'm like, really? So you feel that your right to own a blank, and it's in language in there, was your God-given right? What would that gentleman say if they put a statue for slavery against it, representing slaves and what the slaves went through? How would you feel about that, sir?
Some people in Athens talking about the Confederate Memorial downtown. That piece was produced by GPB's Trevor Young. We continue this special hour of conversation about what to do with the dozens and dozens of Confederate memorials in Georgia. And we've talked a little bit about sort of the middle path, right? Not just completely destroy them or leave them alone, but leave them standing and give them context. Add more information that might make them less a monument or a tribute to the Confederacy. So would that be useful? We have still with us Emory University political science professor Andrew Gillespie. And now let's bring in two new voices. Anne Marshall teaches civil rights history at Mississippi State University. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
And also with us is Dan Moore. He's the founder of the African American Panoramic Experience Museum in Atlanta. Dan, thanks for being with us as well.
It is my pleasure.
So, Anne, there have been efforts in other states to put context on some of these memorials. Has there not? How has that gone?
Yes. Well, I think it's sort of a mixed bag. It works in some places, and it doesn't work in others. Case in point for the latter is in Louisville, Kentucky. There was a big effort several years ago to put up a really nice historical installation called Freedom Park around a Confederate monument that was a really large Confederate monument in the middle of Louisville, and it was also adjacent to the University of Louisville campus. And this installation in Freedom Park had a lot of panels that described the role of African Americans in Louisville history and the role that they played in the Civil War and helping to win the Civil War, as well as the struggles that they faced to attain civil rights. And so I at that point in time thought contextualization was a good idea, sort of watched how, you know, sort of optimistically thinking that this was going to sort of offset, you know, the sort of story of struggle and perseverance and oppression was going to offset this sort of symbol of white power that was standing across the street from it. But really, it didn't satisfy the public. It didn't satisfy the students who went to the University of Louisville and had to look at the monument all the time. It didn't satisfy many of the people who lived in Louisville, and so they continued to put pressure on the city and the university, and ultimately the city and university together removed the monument. And so to me, it's sort of, you know, especially in the face of this renewed use of Confederate symbols by people like Dylan Roof in Charleston and a sort of rallying around the Robert E. Lee statue by white supremacists in Charlottesville sort of underscores that there might be possibilities in terms of historical interpretation involved in contextualization, but that in terms of the public sentiment, it just doesn't always work.
Let's hear a comment from David in Rockmart, Georgia. He left us this voicemail.
I like all history, and the Civil War was part of history. I know it was a rough deal, but, you know, just because you have interest in the Civil War don't make you a racist.
And then we have a, in some ways, conflicting view from Baki Muhammad, and he supports removing Confederate monuments.
No self-respecting Jewish person would want to see swastikas and things that represented Nazism, except maybe in a particular place. And we would not expect others who have been through a Holocaust to have to see those relics of remembrance on a daily basis.
So, Dan, your job is to create historical knowledge and context, right? Adding context work?
Well, I don't think it does, in all honesty. I had the pleasure of serving on a panel created by the mayor several months ago, and he came to the conclusion that just contextualizing it doesn't always dignify it. And you still have a situation where somebody has to tell someone else what that actually means. So imagine a young child, black or white, looking at a statue, looking at a monument, and having it read to them certain information that triggers in their mind something totally different or something that is not even accurate about history. And let's face facts. Memorials are made and are erected to memorialize or to glorify or to honor certain individuals or points in history. When you have individuals who have done what some of these individuals have done, It is no honor, actually.
So, plot twist, Andra, when we talk about contextualizing history and preserving history, an interesting study came out from Georgia State, or UGA, I'm getting it wrong, sorry schools, in which we talked about this study in July, in which they found that people who most support displaying Confederate symbols, like the flag or these monuments, are most likely to not have basic knowledge of the Civil War. So here is Spencer Piston talking about that. He's one of the researchers from Boston University.
White people who are more knowledgeable about the Civil War are less supportive on average of Confederate symbols, such as the Confederate battle emblem. We did not expect to find that. We thought it might be the case that there's something to this sort of pride in the history of the South.
How does this political argument go? Is contextualization, at least for politicians who may be worried about backlash from either side, is this sort of the safe option?
Well, I mean, so Spencer Piston is a good colleague of mine, and one of the things about the operationalization of that study, I found the results very interesting, but they asked two questions, and so it's a question of whether or not you get two questions right, and so it's not...
They asked them to name a battle... from the Civil War and to say who General Sherman was.
Sherman was, right. And so, you know, I would argue, and part of my research now is looking at, okay, we ask more questions, sort of like how does that actually correlate with support for Confederate monuments and other types of things. On the other hand, I just think sort of this project is completely neat. What this looks like in terms of public policy is that sometimes certain voices get amplified in public debate. And I think that a lot of the concern pre-Charlottesville in particular was about erasure, that if it came away, then there would be a generation of people who wouldn't know that this stuff happened, because there are often times where people are very hazy about things that happened even 50 years ago. And so some people, would argue that you should keep them up just as a reminder that bad stuff happened. And so, I think part of that is what's going on. And then also dealing with a vocal minority who is well-heeled and then could mobilize other people to do their bidding for them, I think is also another concern.
We're talking about how to contextualize some of the Confederate monuments in Georgia, possibly. You just heard Andrew Gillespie of Emory University. Let's go back to Ann Marshall of Mississippi State. Now, you mentioned a huge Confederate monument in Louisville, and that's interesting, Ann, because Kentucky was not a Confederate state. It was not part of the Confederacy. Why is there a gigantic Confederate monument in the middle of Louisville?
Yes, well, and it's not just Louisville. It's all over the state of Kentucky. There were almost 100 Confederate monuments in a Union state. And I think this really kind of speaks to the sort of rationale for putting the monuments up in the first place. It really underscores this connection to Jim Crow, sort of lost, how the Lost Cause narrative really really sort of dovetails with Jim Crow policies, because Kentucky was a slave state. It wasn't a Union, or it wasn't a Confederate state, but it was a slave state. So the same impetus that leads whites to put up Confederate monuments in other parts of the South that did secede also works in Kentucky. So I think we see how the rationale works there.
I mean, and it should be pointed out that there are Confederate monuments all over the place. There was one in Montana that just got taken down. There was one in California, in Hollywood, that just recently got removed. I've been to Indiana to look at Confederate monuments. Didn't get to all of them. Oklahoma is another place where there are a lot of Confederate monuments. And so, you know, part of that is migration patterns. And then there's also a recognition that white supremacist views are not just sort of, you know, an artifact of the South. These views are pervasive around the country.
Yes. Well, so, I think, too, one of the things that's important to remember that's hard for us to see is that really these monuments are kind of the tip of the iceberg in this effort to rewrite history and rewrite policy. There's so much that we don't see unless we go back and read old newspapers and that kind of thing. But really, they were just the most visible and permanent symbols of this effort by many white people in the South after the war to retell their history in a certain way. And so, you know, sort of this is just what we see, but there's really so much in terms of making sure, you know, we had the United Daughters of the Confederacy trying to launch these textbook campaigns to make sure that the right version of history gets told. They have groups called Children of the Confederacy, where the children are taught the Confederate Catechism, so that they'll remember history the correct way. So this really is you know, these are what we're debating today, but it was really sort of just one piece of the puzzle.
Part of the argument, Dan, and Dan Moore is the founder of Atlanta's African American Panoramic Experience Museum, part of the argument is that young people, especially today, don't know enough about the Civil War, and research shows us that's actually true. People don't often understand a lot of things about the Civil War. Could these monuments help increase people's knowledge?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, young people don't know much about anything other than tweeting. So when you talk about young people, look at our public school system. We had someone recently who was working with the APEX who had a challenge curriculum because the state of Georgia had a curriculum which says Africans were brought here to help pick cotton, and it skipped from that to Martin Luther King Jr. So if you have that in the history books, how much more can we expect young people to have to know if the history books don't even tell us anything about history? I'm from the North, I'm from Philadelphia, and I was surprised.
Congratulations on the Super Bowl.
Yes. I was surprised when I came to the South, and on what's now President's Day, was at that time Lincoln's birthday, which was not honored, of course, in the South. They honored George Washington's birthday, but didn't honor Lincoln's birthday. So when you think about statues and monuments, they carry a lot of weight because they're large, they're huge monuments made of steel or whatever they're made of, and they loom over a society, so they look almost imposing, and that makes people revere them. And I think someone mentioned about Stone Mountain, and you have these monuments that even with contextualization don't really tell the story that we are supposed or should be telling.
We're also talking, Andra, in the end about a very large expense because there are lots of these statues. And I should mention they don't have a lot of just pure artistic value. Many of them were mass produced. They look remarkably the same. It's basically the same Confederate soldier leaning against a tree trunk for some reason, I don't know, and holding his rifle in front of him. So when we talk about contextualization, is there even the funding or the will in place among politicians to pay for that?
No. And so some cities are coming up with creative ways to deal with that. So it could be selling parks, to, you know, as they did in Memphis, to private entities that can then shoulder the responsibility of moving those things around. And then once you get past Confederate monuments themselves, it's looking at all the other things. So street names, school names, you know, military installations. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. So I grew up with, you know, Confederate monuments all everywhere. And, you know, even today, like my last trip home, next to the last trip home, I saw a Confederate monument I had never paid attention to before and just looked and went, oh, that's a Confederate monument. But it's stuff like Fort Lee. Like, it didn't occur to me that Southern military bases were named after Confederate generals because it was Fort Lee. It wasn't Fort Robert E. Lee in my head until that got pointed out after Charleston. And it was like, oh, I see that all the time, right? And so, I mean, that's, I think, the mindset. And I think on one hand, if you're cognizant of history, it is a reminder of how pervasive racism is in American society. But if you're not, you can be inured to it in ways that could be particularly dangerous. And we've just got to figure out a way to strike that balance.
That is Emory University political science professor Andra Gillespie. She's been with us all hour. Thank you, Andra.
Thank you.
And thank you to Ann Marshall, assistant history professor at Mississippi State University, and Dan Moore, founder of the African American Panoramic Experience Museum in Atlanta. Thanks to both of you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but of course we need to hear from you. We've been hearing from you a lot. What do you think should be done about the nearly 200 Confederate monuments that are sitting now on public land in Georgia? Call us at 404-500-9457. Find us on social media. For today, that's on Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.